He saw that the trawlers had dragged the crippled Gubru patrol boat nearly to the dock. A number of other Chim-crewed vessels cruised farther out, but none of them crossed a line of buoys that could be seen stretching all the way across the bay. Barnaby looked left and right, then spoke in a low voice.
"Ah, Fibbin, there are quite a few Chims in town who... well, who've been reorganizing. I had to give parole when I got my brassard back, but I can get word to Professor Oakes that you're in town. I'm sure he'd want to get together a meeting tonight."
Fibbin shook his head.
"No time. I've got to get over there."
He motioned to where the bright aircraft were alighting on the far headlands. Barnaby's lips drew back.
"I don't know, Fibbin. Those watch boys, they've kept everybody back."
"Have they actually burned anybody?"
"Well, no, not that I've seen, but..."
Barnaby stopped as Fibbin shook the reins and nudged with his heels.
"Thanks, Barnaby. That's all I needed to know," he said.
The proctors stood aside as Tycho stepped along the wharf. Farther out, the little rescue flotilla had just come to dock, and were even now tying up the prim white Gubru warcraft. The Chim sailors did a lot of bowing and moved in uncomfortable crouched postures under the glare of the irritated Talon soldiers and their fearsome battle drones. In contrast, Fibbin steered his steed just outside of the range that would have required him to acknowledge the aliens. His posture was erect, and he ignored them completely as he rode past the patrol boat to the far end of the pier, where the smallest of the fishing boats had just come to rest. He swung his feet over the saddle and hopped down.
"Are you good to animals?"
he asked the startled sailor, who looked up from securing his craft. When he nodded, Fibbin handed the dumbfounded Chim Tycho's reins.
"Then we'll swap."
He leaped aboard the little craft and stepped behind the cockpit.
"Send a bill for the difference to the suzerain for propriety. You got that? The Gubru suzerain of propriety."
The wide-eyed Chen seemed to notice that his jaw was hanging open. He closed it with an audible clack. Fibbin switched the ignition on and felt satisfied with the engine's throaty roar.
"Cast off," he said.
Then he smiled.
"And thanks. Take good care of Tycho."
The sailor blinked. He seemed about to decide to get angry when some of the Chims who had followed Fibbin caught up. One whispered in the boatman's ear. The fisherman then grinned. He hurried to untie the boat's tether and threw the rope back onto the foredeck. When Fibbin awkwardly hit the pier backing up, the Chim only winced slightly.
Good luck, he managed to say.
"Yeah, luck, Fibbin,"
Barnaby shouted. Fibbin waved and shifted the impellers into forward. He swung about in a wide arc, passing almost under the duroplast sides of the Gubru patrol craft. Up close, it did not look quite so glistening white. In fact, the armored hull looked pitted and corroded. High, indignant chirps from the other side of the vessel indicated the frustration of the Talon soldier crew. Fibbin spared them not a thought as he turned about and got his borrowed boat headed southward, toward the line of buoys that split the bay and kept the Chims of Port Helena away from the high, patron-level doings on the opposite shore. Foamed and choppy from the wind, the water was cinerescent with the usual garbage the easterlies always brought in this time of year, everything from leaves to almost transparent plate-ivy parachutes, to the feathers of molting birds. Pippin had to slow to avoid clots of debris, as well as battered boats of all description crowded with Chim sightseers. He approached the barrier line at low speed and felt thousands of eyes watching him as he passed the last shipload, containing the most daring and curious of the Port Hellenians.
"Goodall, do I really know what I'm doing?"
he wondered. He had been acting almost on automatic so far, but now it came to him that he really was out of his depth here. What did he hope to accomplish by charging off this way? What was he going to do? Crash the ceremony? He looked at the towering starships across the bay, glistening in power and splendor. As if he had any business sticking his half-uplifted nose into the affairs of beings from great and ancient clans. All he'd accomplish would be to embarrass himself, and probably his whole race, for that matter.
"Gotta think about this," he muttered.
Fibbin brought the boat's engine down to idle as the line of buoys neared. He thought about how many people were watching him right now.
"My people," he recalled. I was supposed to represent them. Yes, but I ducked out. Obviously, the suzerain realized its mistake and made other arrangements. Or the other suzerains won, and I'd simply be dead meat if I showed up."
He wondered what they would think if they knew that only days ago he had manhandled and helped kidnap one of his own patrons, and his legal commander at that. Some race representative.
"Galet doesn't need the likes of me. She's better off without me."
Fibbin twisted the wheel, causing the boat to come about just short of one of the white buoys. He watched it go by as he turned. It, too, looked less than new on close examination, somewhat corroded, in fact. But then, from his own lowly state, who was he to judge? Fibbin blinked at that thought. Now that was laying it on too thick. He stared at the buoy, and slowly his lips curled back.
Why, you devious sons of bitches!
Fibbin cut the impellers and let the engine drop back to idle. He closed his eyes and pressed his hands against his temples, trying to concentrate.
I was girding myself against another fear barrier, like the one at the city fence that night. But this one is more subtle. It plays on my sense of my own unworthiness. It trades on my humility.
He opened his eyes and looked back at the buoy. Finally, he grinned.
"What humility?"
Fibbin asked aloud. He laughed and turned the wheel as he set the craft in motion again. This time, when he headed for the barrier, he did not hesitate or listen to the doubts that the machines tried to cram into his head.
"After all," he muttered, "what can they do to shake the confidence of a fellow who's got delusions of adequacy?"
The enemy had made a serious mistake here, Fibbin knew, as he left the buoys behind him, and with them their artificially induced doubts. The resolution that flowed back into him now was fortified by its very contrast to the earlier depths. He approached the opposite headland, wearing a fierce scowl of determination. Something flapped against his knee. Fibbin glanced down and saw the silvery ceremonial robe, the one he had found in the closet back at the old prison. He had crammed it under his belt, apparently, just before leaping atop Tycho and riding pell-mell for the harbor. No wonder people had been staring at him back at the docks. Fibbin laughed. Holding onto the wheel with one hand, he wriggled into the silky garment as he headed toward a silent stretch of beach. The bluffs cut off any view of what was going on the seaside of the narrow peninsula, but the drone of still-descending aircraft was, he hoped, a sign that he might not be too late. He ran the boat aground on a shelf of sparkling white sand, now made unattractive under a tidal wash of flotsam. Fibbin was about to leap into the knee-high surf when he glanced back and noticed that something seemed to be going on back in Port Helena. Faint cries of excitement carried over the water. The churning mass of brown forms at the dockside was now surging to the right. He plucked up the pair of binoculars that hung by the capstan and focused them on the wharf area. Chims ran about, many of them pointing excitedly eastward toward the main entrance to town. Some were still running in that direction, but now more and more seemed to be heading the other way, apparently not so much in fear as in confusion. Some of the more excitable chims capered about. A few even fell into the water and had to be rescued by the more level-headed. Whatever was happening did not seem to be causing panic so much as acute, near-total bewilderment. Fibbon did not have time to hang around and piece together this added puzzle. By now he thought he understood his own modest powers of concentration.
"Focus on just one problem at a time," he told himself. "Get to Galet. Tell her you're sorry you ever left her. Tell her you'll never, ever do it again."
That was easy enough even for him to understand. Fibbon found a narrow trail leading up from the beach. It was crumbling and dangerous, especially in the gusting winds. Still, he hurried, and his pace was held down only by the amount of oxygen his limited lungs and heart could pump. Chapter 84 Uthukalding. The four of them made a strange-looking group, hurrying northward under overcast skies. Perhaps some little native animals looked up and stared at them, blinking in momentary astonishment before they ducked back into their burrows and swore off the eating of overripe seeds ever again. To Uthukalding, though, the forced march was something of a humiliation. Each of the others, it seemed, had advantages over him. Kalt puffed and huffed and obviously did not like the rugged ground. But once the hulking Thenanin got moving, he kept up a momentum that seemed unstoppable. As for Jojo, well, the little Chim seemed by now to be a creature of this environment. He was under strict orders from Uthukalding never to knuckle-walk within sight of Kalt. No sense in taking a chance with arousing the Thenanin's suspicions. But when the terrain got too rugged, he sometimes just scrambled over an obstacle rather than going around it. And over the long, flat stretches, Jojo simply rode Robert's back. Robert had insisted on carrying the Chim, whatever the official gulf in status between them. The human lad was impatient enough as it was. Clearly, he would rather have run all the way. The change in Robert on Eagle was astonishing, and far more than physical. Last night, when Kalt asked him to explain part of his story for the third time, Robert clearly and unself-consciously manifested a simple version of Tivnus over his head. Uthukalding could ken how the human deftly used the glyph to contain his frustration so that none of it would spill over into outward discourtesy to the Thenanin. Uthukalding could see that there was much Robert was not telling, but what he said was enough.
"I knew that Megan underestimated her son, but of this I had no expectation."
Clearly he had underrated his own daughter as well.
"Clearly."
Uthukalding tried not to resent his flesh and blood for her power, the power to rob him of more than he had thought he could ever lose. He struggled to keep up with the others, but Uthukalding's change nodes already throbbed tiredly. It wasn't just that Timbrimi were more talented at adaptability than endurance. It was also a fault in his will. The others had purpose, even enthusiasm. He had only duty to keep him going. Kalt stopped at the top of a rise, where the looming mountains towered near and imposing. Already they were entering a forest of scrub trees that gained stature as they ascended. Uthukalding looked up at the steep slopes ahead, already misted in what might be snow clouds, and hoped they would not have to climb much farther. Kalt's massive hand closed around his as the Thenanin helped him up the final few meters. He waited patiently as Uthukalding rested, breathing heavily through wide-open nostrils.
"I still can scarcely believe what I have been told," Kalt said. "Something about the Earthling's story does not ring true, my colleague."
"Tufanatu,"
Utha Kalding switched to Anglic, which seemed to take less air.
What do you find hard to believe, Kalt? Do you think Robert is lying?"
Kalt waved his hands in front of himself, his ridge crest inflated indignantly.
"Certainly not. I only believe that the young fellow is naive."
"Naive? In what way?"
Utha Kalding could look up now without his vision splitting into two separate images in his cortex. Robert and Jojo weren't in sight. They must have gone on ahead.
"I mean that the Gubru are obviously up to much more than they claim. The deal they are offering, peace with Earth in exchange for tenancy on some Garthian islands and minor genetic purchase rights from neo-chimpanzee stock. Such a deal seems barely worth the cost of an interstellar ceremony. It is my suspicion that they are after something else on the sly, my friend."
"What do you think they want?"
Kalt swung his almost neckless head left and right, as if looking to make sure no one else was within listening range. His voice dropped in both volume and timbre.
"I suspect that they intend to perform a snap adoption."
"Adoption? Oh, you mean..."
"Garthlings," Kalt finished for him. "This is why it is so fortunate your Earthling allies brought us this news. We can only hope that they will be able to provide transport as they promised, or we will never be in time to prevent a terrible tragedy."
Utha Kalding mourned all that he had lost. For Kalt had raised a perplexing question, one well worth a well-crafted glyph of delicate wryness. He had been successful, of course, beyond his wildest expectations. According to Robert, the Gubru had swallowed the Garthling myth, hook, line, and sinker, at least for long enough to cause them harm and embarrassment. Kalt, too, had come to believe in the ghostly fable, but what was one to make of Kalt's claim that his own instruments verified the story? Incredible. And now the Gubru seemed to be behaving as if they, too, had more to go on than the fabricated clues he had left. They, too, acted as if there were confirmation. The old Utha Kalding would have crafted Sealf-Kuan to commemorate such amazing turns. At this moment, though, all he felt was confused and very tired. A shout caused them both to turn. Utha Kalding squinted, wishing right then that he could trade some of his unwanted empathy sense for better eyesight. Atop the next ridge, he made out the form of Robert Onigle. Seated atop the young human's shoulders, Jojo waved at them. And something else was there, too, a blue glimmering that seemed to spin next to the two Earth creatures and radiate all of the goodwill of a perfect prankster. It was the beacon, the light that had led Utha Kalding ever onward since the crash months before.
"What are they saying?" Kalt asked. "I cannot quite make out the words."
Neither could Utha Kalding, but he knew what the Terrans were saying.
"I believe they are telling us that we don't have very much farther to go," he said with some relief. "They are saying that they have found our transport."
The Thenanin's breathing slits puffed in satisfaction.
"Good. Now, if only we can trust the Gubru to follow custom and proper truce behavior when we appear and offer correct diplomatic treatment to accredited envoys."
Utha Kalving nodded. But as they began marching uphill together again, he knew that that was only one of their worries. Chapter 85 Athaclena. She tried to suppress her feelings. To the others, this was serious, even tragic. But there was just no way to keep it in. Her delight would not be contained. Subtle, ornate glyphs spun off from her waving tendrils and diffracted away through the trees, filling the glades with her hilarity. Athaclena's eyes were at their widest divergence, and she covered her mouth with her hand, so the doer chims would not see her human-style smile as well. The portable hollow unit had been set up on a ridgetop overlooking the Sindh to the northwest, in order to improve reception. It showed the scene being broadcast just then from Port Helena. Under the truce, censorship had been lifted. And even without humans, the capital had plenty of Chim news hounds on the spot, with mobile cameras to show all the debris in stunning detail.
"I can't stand it," Benjamin moaned.
Elaine Sue muttered helplessly as she watched.
"That tears it."
The chimney spoke volumes indeed, for the hollow tank displayed what was left of the fancy wall the invaders had thrown around Port Helena, now literally ripped down and torn to shreds. Stunned Chim citizens milled about a scene that looked as if a cyclone had hit it. They stared around in amazement, picking through the shattered remnants. A few of those who were more exuberant than thoughtful threw pieces of fence material into the air jubilantly. Some even made chest-thumping motions in honor of the unstoppable wave that had crested there only minutes before, then surged onward into the town itself. On most of the stations, the voiceover was computer-generated, but on Channel 2, a Chim announcer was able to speak over his excitement.
At first, we all thought it was a nightmare come true. You know, like an archetype out of an old Twin Sen flat movie. Nothing would stop them. They crashed through the Gubru barrier as if it was made of tissue paper. I don't know about anybody else, but at any moment I expected the biggest of them to go around grabbing our prettiest chimneys and drag them screaming all the way to the top of the Terrigan's Tower.
Athaclena clapped her hand tighter over her mouth in order to keep from laughing out loud. She fought for self-control, and she was not alone. For one of the Chims, Fibbin's friend Sylvie, let out a high chirp of laughter. Most of the others frowned at her in disapproval. After all, this was serious. But Athaclena met the Chimmy's eyes and recognized the light in them.
"But it appears that these creatures aren't complete Kongs, after all. After their demolishment of the fence, they don't seem to have done much more damage in their sudden invasion of Port Helena. Mostly right now, they're just milling around, opening doors, eating fruit, going wherever they want to. After all, where does a 400-pound gor... Oh, never mind."
This time another Chim joined Sylvie. Athaclena's vision blurred, and she shook her head. The announcer went on.
"They seem completely unaffected by the Gubru's psi drones, which apparently aren't tuned to their brain patterns."
Actually, Athaclena and the mountain fighters had known for more than 2 days where the guerrillas were headed. After their first frantic attempts to divert the powerful pre-sentience, they gave up the effort as useless. The guerrillas politely pushed aside or stepped over anybody who got in their way. There had simply been no stopping them. Not even April Wu. The little blonde girl had apparently made up her mind to go and find her parents, and short of risking injury to her, there was no way anybody would be able to pry her off the shoulders of one of the giant silver-backed males. Anyway, April had told the Chims quite matter-of-factly,
Somebody had to go along and supervise the Rillas, or they might get into trouble.
Athaclina remembered little April's words as she looked at the mess the presentients had made of the Gubru wall.
I'd hate to see the trouble they could cause if they weren't supervised.
Anyway, with the secret out, there was no reason the human child should not be reunited with her family. Nothing she said could hurt anybody now. So much for the last secrecy of the Howlett Center project. Now Athaclina might as well just toss away all the evidence she had so dutifully gathered that first fateful evening so many months ago. Soon the entire five galaxies would know about these creatures, and by some measures that was indeed a tragedy. And yet, Athaclina remembered that day in early spring when she had been so shocked and indignant to come upon the illegal uplift experiment hidden in the forest. Now she could scarcely believe she had actually been like that.
Was I really such a serious, officious little prig?
Now, Sealf Kuan was only the simplest, most serious of the glyphs she sparked off, casually, tirelessly, in joy over a simply marvelous joke. Even the Chims could not help being affected by her profligate aura. Two more laughed when one of the channels showed an alien staff car manned by squawking, irate Kwaku in the process of being peeled back by gorillas who seemed passionately interested in how it would taste. Another Chim chuckled. The laughter spread.
Yes, she thought. It is a wonderful jest.
To a Timbrimi, the best jokes were those that caught the joker as well as everybody else, and this fit the bill beautifully. It was, in truth, a religious experience, for her people believed in a universe that was more than mere clockwork physics, more than even Ifni's capricious flux of chance and luck. It was when something like this happened, the Timbrimi sages said, that one really knew that God himself was still in charge.
Was I then also an agnostic before? How silly of me. Thank you then, Lord, and thank you too, Father, for this miracle.
The scene shifted to the dock area, where milling Chims danced in the streets and stroked the fur of their giant, patient cousins. In spite of the likely tragic consequences of all this, Athaclina and her warriors could not help but smile at the delight the brown-furred relations obviously took in each other. For now, at least, their pride was shared by all the Chims of Port Helena. Even Lieutenant Lydia McHugh and her wary corporal could not help but laugh when a gorilla baby danced past the cameras, wearing a necklace made of broken Gubru psi globes. They caught a glimpse of little April, riding in triumph through the streets, and the sight of a human child seemed to galvanize the crowds. By now the glade was saturated with her glyphs. Athaclina turned and walked away, leaving the others to resonate in the wry joy. She moved up a forest trail until she came to a place with a clear view of the mountains to the west. There she stood, reaching and kenning with her tendrils. It was there that a Chim messenger found her. He hurried up and saluted before handing her a slip of paper. Athaclina thanked him and opened it, though she thought she already knew what it would say.
"With Tana, with the calling,"
she said softly. Her father was back in touch with the world again. For all of the events of the past few months, there was a solid, practical part of her still, who was relieved to have this confirmation by radio. She had had faith that Robert would succeed, of course. That was why she had not gone to Port Helena with Fibbon, or, after that, with the gorillas. What could she accomplish there, with her poor expertise, that her father could not do 1,000 times better? If anyone could help turn their slim hopes into more and still greater miracles, it would be Uta Calding. No, her job was to remain here. For even in the event of miracles, the Infinite expected mortals to provide their own insurance. She shaded her eyes. Although she had no hope of personally sighting a little aircraft against the bright clouds, she kept looking for a tiny dot that would be carrying all her love and all her prayers. Chapter 86 Galactics. Gay pavilions dotted the manicured hillside, occasionally billowing and flapping in the gusting breeze. Quick robots hurried to pluck up any debris brought in by the wind. Others fetched and carried refreshments to the gathered dignitaries. Galactics of many shapes and colors milled in small groups that merged and separated in an elegant pavane of diplomacy. Courteous bows and flattenings and tentacle wavings conveyed complex nuances of status and protocol. A knowledgeable observer might tell a great deal from such subtleties, and there were many knowledgeable observers present on this day. Informal exchanges abounded as well. Here a squat, bear-like Pila conversed in clipped, ultrasonic tones with a gangling Linton gardener. A little upslope, three Jofer ring priests keened in harmonious complaint to an official from the War Institute over some alleged violation out among the star lanes. It was often said that much more practical diplomacy was accomplished at these uplift ceremonies than at formal negotiation conferences. More than one new alliance might be made today, and more than one broken. Only a few of the galactic visitors spared more than passing attention to those being honored here today. A caravan of small brown forms, which had taken the entire morning to labor halfway up the mound, circling it four times along the way. By now, nearly a third of the neo-chimpanzee candidates had failed one test or another. Those rejected were already trooping back down the sloping path in downcast ones and twos. The remaining 40 or so continued their ascent, symbolically reiterating the process of uplift that had brought their race to this stage in its history, but ignored, for the most part, by the bright crowds on the slopes. Not all of the observers were inattentive, of course. Near the pinnacle, the commissioners from the Galactic Uplift Institute paid close attention to the results relayed up by each test station. And nearby, from beneath their own pavilion, a party of the neo-chimpanzees' human patrons watched, glumly. Looking somewhat lost and helpless, they had been brought out from Silmar Island only this morning. A few mayors, professors, and a member of the local uplift board. The delegation had put forward a procedural protest over the irregular way the ceremony had come about, but when pressed, none of the humans actually claimed a right to cancel it altogether. The possible consequences were potentially just too drastic. Besides, what if this were the real thing? Earth had been agitating to be allowed to hold just such a ceremony for neo-chimpanzees for 200 years. The human observers definitely looked unhappy, for they had no idea what to do, and few of the grand galactic envoys present even deigned to acknowledge them amid the flurry of informal diplomacy. On the opposite side of the evaluator's pavilion sat the elegant sponsor's tent. Many Gubru and Kwaku stood just outside, nervously hopping from time to time, watching every detail with unblinking, critical eyes. Until moments ago, the Gubru triumvirate had been visible also, two of them strutting about with their molt colorings already starting to show, and the third still obstinately perched upon its pedestal. Then, one of them received a message, and all three disappeared into the tent for an urgent parley. That had been some time ago. They still had not emerged. The suzerain of Cost and Caution fluttered and spat as it let the message drop to the floor.
"I protest. I protest this interference. This interference and intolerable betrayal."
The suzerain of Propriety stared down from its perch, totally at a loss. The suzerain of Cost and Caution had proved to be a crafty opponent, but never had it been purposely obtuse. Obviously, something had happened to upset it terribly. Crouching Kwaku servitors hurriedly plucked up the message pellet it had dropped, duplicated the capsule, and brought copies to the other two Gubru lords. When the suzerain of Propriety viewed the data, it could scarcely believe what it saw. It was a solitary neo-chimpanzee, climbing the lower slopes of the towering ceremonial mound, passing rapidly through the automatic first-stage screens, and gradually beginning to close the wide gap, separating it from the official party higher on the hillside. The neo-chimp moved with an erect determination, a clearness of purpose that could be read in its very posture. Those of its conspecifics who had already failed and who were spiraling slowly down the long trail again, first stared, then grinned, and reached out to touch the newcomer's robe as he passed. They offered words of encouragement.
"This was not, cannot have been rehearsed,"
the suzerain of Beam and Talon hissed. The military commander cried out,
"It is an interloper, and I shall have it burned down." "You should not, must not, shall not,"
the suzerain of Propriety squawked back in anger.
"There has not yet been a coalescence, no complete molting. You do not yet have a queen's wisdom. Ceremonies are run, governed, ruled by traditions of honor. All members of a client race may approach and be tried, tested, evaluated."
The third Gubru lord snapped its beak open and shut in agitation. Finally, the suzerain of Cost and Caution fluffed its ragged feathers and agreed.
"We would be charged reparations. The Institute officials might leave, depart, lay sanctions. The cost..."
It turned away in a downy huff.
"Let it proceed, then. For now, alone, solitary, in isolation, it can do no harm."
But the suzerain of Propriety was not so sure. Once it had set great store in this particular client. When it seemed to have been stolen, the suzerain of Propriety suffered a serious setback. Now, however, it realized the truth. The neo-chimp male had not been stolen and eliminated by its rivals, the other suzerains. Instead, the chimp had actually escaped. And now it was back, alone. How? And what did it hope to accomplish? Without guidance, without the aid of a group, how far did it think it could go? At first, on seeing the creature, the suzerain of Propriety had felt joyful amazement, an unusual sensation for a Gubru. Now its emotion was something even more uncomfortable, a worry that this was only the beginning of surprise. Chapter 87 Fibbon. So far it had been a piece of cake. Fibbon wondered what all the fuss was about. He had feared they would ask him to solve calculus problems in his head, or recite like Demosthenes with marbles in his mouth. But at first there had only been a series of force-screen barriers that peeled back for him automatically, and after that there were only more of those funny-looking instruments he had seen the Gubru techs use weeks, months ago, now wielded by even funnier-looking aliens. So far, so good. He made it around the first circuit in what had to be record speed. Oh, a few times they asked him some questions. What was his earliest memory? Did he enjoy his profession? Was he satisfied with the physical form of this generation of neo-chimpanzee, or might it be improved somehow? Would a prehensile tail be a convenient aid in tool use, for instance? Galet would have been proud of the way he remained polite, even then. Or at least, he hoped she'd be proud of him. Of course, the galactic officials had his entire record, genetic, scholastic, military, and were able to access it the moment he passed a group of startled Talon soldiers on the Bayside Bluffs and strode through the outer barriers to meet his first test. When a tall, tree-like Contan asked him about the note he had left that night when he escaped from imprisonment, it was clear that the Institute was capable of subpoenaing the invader's records as well. He answered truthfully that Galet had worded the document, but that he had understood its purpose and concurred. The Contan's foliage tinkled in the chiming of tiny silvery bells. The semi-vegetable galactic sounded pleased and amused as it shuffled aside to let him pass. The intermittent wind helped keep Fibbon cool as long as he was on the eastward slopes, but the westward side faced the afternoon sun and was sheltered from the breeze. The effort of maintaining his rapid pace made him feel as if he were wearing a thick coat, even though a chim's sparse covering of body hair was technically not fur at all. The park-like hill was neatly landscaped, and the trail paved with a soft, resilient surface. Nevertheless, through his toes, he sensed a faint trembling, as if the entire artificial mountain were throbbing in harmonies far, far below the level of hearing. Fibbon, who had seen the massive power plants before they were buried, knew that it was not his imagination. At the next station, a Pring technician with huge glowing eyes and bulging lips looked him up and down and noted something in a data well before allowing him to proceed. Now some of the dignitaries dotting the slopes seemed to have begun to notice him. A few drifted nearer and accessed his test results in curiosity. Fibbon bowed courteously to those nearby and tried not to think about all the different kinds of eyes that were watching him, like some sort of specimen. "Once their ancestors had to go through something like this," he consoled himself. Twice Fibbon passed a few spirals below the party of official candidates, a gradually dwindling band of brownish creatures in short, silvery robes. The first time he hurried by, none of the chims noticed him. On the second occasion, though, he had to stand under the scrutiny of instruments held by a being whose species he could not even identify. That time he was able to make out a few figures among those up above, and some of the chims noticed him as well. One nudged a companion and pointed, but then they all disappeared around the corner again. He had not seen Galet, but then she would likely be at the head of the party, wouldn't she? "Come on," Fibbon muttered impatiently, concerned over the time this creature was taking. Then he considered that the machines focused on him might read either his words or his mood, and he concentrated on preserving discipline. He smiled sweetly and bowed as the alien technician indicated a passing score with a few terse, computer-mediated words. Fibbon hurried on. He grew more and more irritated with the long distances between the stations, and wondered if there wasn't any dignified way he could run in order to cut down on the gap even faster. Instead, though, things only started going slower as the tests grew more serious, calling for deeper learning and more complex thought. Soon, he met more chims on their way back down. Apparently, these were now forbidden to talk to him, but a few rolled their eyes meaningfully, and their bodies were damp with perspiration. He recognized several of these dropouts. Two were professors at the college in Port Helena. Others were scientists with the Garth Ecological Recovery Program. Fibbon began to grow worried. All of these chims were blue card types, among the brightest. If they were failing, something had to be very wrong here. Certainly, this ceremony wasn't perfunctory, as that celebration for the title, which Athaclina had told him about. Perhaps the rules were stacked against Earthlings.